Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 83. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's wonderful to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome Debbie and Emily, who joined the Talking Tudors family in July. I'm so very thankful for your support and immense generosity. If you love the podcast, if you never miss an episode, perhaps you'd consider becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family, and in addition to receiving lots of Tudor-themed goodies, you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. August's prize is a copy of The Falcon's Flight, a novel of Anne Boleyn by Natalia Richards. A huge thank you to the author for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Jane Seymour is Adrian Dillard. Adrian is a graduate with a Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Studies with emphasis in history from Montana State University Northern. She's been an eager student of history for most of her life and has completed in-depth research on the American Revolutionary Wartime period in American history and the history and sinking of the Titanic. Her senior university capstone paper was on the discrepancies in passenger lists on the ill-fated liner, and Adrian was able to work with Encyclopaedia Titanica for much of her research on that subject. Her previous works include best-selling novel Cor Rotto, a novel of Catherine Carey, and Catherine Carey in a Nutshell for Made Global's History in a Nutshell series. Her newest novel, The Raven's Widow, was released in February 2017. When she isn't writing, Adrian works as an administrative assistant in the financial services industry and enjoys spending time with her son Logan at their home in the Pacific Northwest. My conversation with Adrian straight after this musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Talking Tudors, Adrian. How are you?
I'm great, Natalie. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. And we were just having a little giggle because we can see each other and you're in your summer outfit and I'm in my complete winter gear, which is quite funny.
You know, we need to just like swap.
I think we do, because I'm quite tired of being cold. But anyway, let's move on from there. So in March 2019, so it's gone so quick, gosh, you and I chatted about Catherine Carey and Jane Boleyn. And that was episode 26, if anyone would like to have a listen. But since then, we've had lots of new listeners find the show, which is fantastic. So it would be really great if you could introduce yourself again and just tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I was born and mostly raised in a small town in Montana, where my high school teachers left a very deep impression upon me, inspiring my love of history. I went on to graduate with a bachelor's degree in liberal studies, focusing not only on history, but also on political science and economics, with a minor in community service. I've gone through many phases in my life, including a very notable obsession with all things Titanic. In fact, my historiography thesis was a study of the discrepancies in the liner's passenger lists. So I found that very interesting. I'm also very interested in the American Revolution and Greek mythology, which I'm happy to say is explored in my forthcoming novel. Currently, I live in the Pacific Northwest with my 11-year-old son. And when I'm not writing, I work for an investment firm where I am a licensed client relationship manager, which means I can give people financial advice, but I don't.
Fabulous. And actually, you and I both share that obsession with the Titanic. I love that as well. That could be a whole different conversation, couldn't it?
Oh, it could. And it's really funny how many people who love both Titanic and the Tudors, for some reason, like, they just seem to go together.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, you have written two absolutely wonderful Tudor novels, Corotto, a novel of Catherine Carey, and The Raven's Widow, a novel of Jane Boleyn. And thankfully for all of us Tudor history lovers, you're working on your third novel, yes. Could you tell us about these novels and what inspired you to write them?
Well, Corotto is about Catherine Carey Knowles, the daughter of Mary Boleyn and William Carey, or possibly Henry VIII, if you're feeling sassy like I usually am. And The Raven's Widow focuses on Jane Parker Boleyn, the horribly slandered and maligned wife of George Boleyn. And as you can tell by my description, my version of Jane is both sympathetic and far more likely to be accurate than the scheming shrew. That's a tongue twister. The scheming shrew she is usually portrayed as. Because rather than rely on the propaganda that has permeated pop culture, my research has been based upon the primary contemporary documents. So I like to tell my stories with as much accuracy as possible. The novels are meant to be part of a series, but they can be read together or separately in any order. And, you know, I like to just explore stories that we haven't really, from a perspective we haven't really heard from, or I like to take things that have been accepted as fact and kind of flip it on their head and try to give people something different to think about. So that was why I wrote Catherine's story, was because we had never heard from her before. And ironically, Wendy Dunn's book about Catherine, the young adult version of Catherine, of her as a young girl, Light in the Labyrinth, which is a beautiful book, came out a month before Corrado did. So it was kind of interesting that we had no novels about Catherine, and then we got two within a month of each other.
And then, that's so interesting how that happens. I find that actually happens quite a lot, where there's kind of an idea floating around in the ether somewhere, and then a few people manage to, you know, grasp onto it, and you get several works, creative works about the same thing. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was just time for her story to be told. So we told it, and then Jane's story was just inspired because, you know, I don't believe that she is guilty of all the things that have been lobbed at her. And so I wanted to give somebody a different perspective of who she might have actually been, instead of this caricature that we're so familiar with.
Yeah, I absolutely love your portrayal of Jane Boleyn. I highly recommend anyone listening that's interested to go and read it, because I think it is fiction, obviously, but I know how well you research your novels, and it just makes her so much more human and so much more three-dimensional. So, yeah, highly recommend that, definitely.
Oh, thank you.
Adrian, for the last few years, I know you've been really busy working on a new novel, because obviously you work full time and you write. So this is a huge undertaking. So can you tell us a little bit about this new novel without giving too much away?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, of course, you know, readers who are already familiar with my work know that I'm a huge fan of rehabilitating so-called villains and telling stories from a point of view we rarely see. So a few months after I finished writing Raven, I started to really think about someone that I may have given sort of short shrift in that novel, which was Marjorie Horseman. Every time I wrote about her, her voice came through. It just seems so thoroughly unpleasant. And I just don't, I didn't know why. And so I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into her story. And, you know, of course, there isn't much out there about Marjorie. So I knew I had to incorporate another voice so I would have enough story. And then that's where Jane Seymour came in. So the story is told from their alternating points of view and opens the day of Anne Boleyn's execution when Marjorie comes into possession of the murdered queen's iconic necklace, the bee necklace. And so there's a little bit of mystery as to what she does with it and where it inevitably ends up. And then from there, it follows Jane's short reign in untimely death.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Now, I don't think in, you know, 80 plus episodes I've ever focused on Jane Seymour. Oops, sorry. So I'm really looking forward to chatting. What do we know of her early life and upbringing?
Well, we don't know a lot, purely because she came from a very humble background, despite being descended from royalty. She was born in 1508, and we know that because the number of mourners at her funeral. And she was born in the Wiltshire countryside and would have been trained in what I call the womanly arts, which was sewing, praying, obedience. However, she had an advantage living so close to the lush hunting grounds in the Savernake Forest. I don't know if I said that right. Savernake Forest. So she would have also learned plenty of outdoor skills, and she was an expert horsewoman. Her mother was a famed beauty known for inspiring the poet John Skelton. So it is rather ironic that the eldest Seymour daughter would come to be known for being so plain. She probably wasn't given a classical education, but she would have known how to run a household. And I would also venture to guess that she may have picked up a basic understanding of either or both French and Spanish, purely due to the time her elder brother spent in the two countries. Usually, you know, everybody thinks that she was really dumb, but I don't think that that's true. I think that she was just very careful of how much of her knowledge she revealed. I think for as close as she was to her brothers and as much time as Edward spent abroad, there's no reason why she wouldn't have picked up some of those things from him. And plus, it would have helped her a great deal while she served at court, because those were two languages that were spoken very frequently there.
Okay. And do we know when she first was appointed to a position at court?
Well, most historians agree that Jane came to court around 1527 with the help of her cousin, Sir Francis Bryan, who was a favored courtier at the time, and her brother, Edward, who was also quickly rising through the ranks. She served both Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, and though much has been made about her dislike for the latter, they seem to have rubbed along well enough until Jane caught the eye of the king. In fact, prior to that, Edward and Anne Seymour seem to have supported Anne mostly because of her religious leanings, because they were both pretty, progressive reformers as well. And in fact, Anne Seymour's stepfather, Richard Page, was one of the men who was imprisoned alongside the other men during Anne's fall. He was later released, but he was exiled from court.
Okay. And when do you think that Henry began to show an interest in Jane?
Well, there's a possibility that Jane was the lady whom the king was distracted by during a January 1535 banquet in honor of the French ambassador. This, of course, is one of those really great scenes in The Tudors when, you know, Anne starts laughing because Henry's kind of gotten distracted by this pretty woman, and the French ambassador thinks that, you know, she's laughing at him. Great scene. But that probably wasn't Jane. There's some possibility, and most historians place the beginning of his interest during the Autumn Progress later that year when the royal couple stayed at Jane's family home, Wolf Hall. It's certainly local legend and the basis for the very popular historical fiction series. However, it's still far from certain. We don't even know if Jane was there on the visit. So the first sure date comes from, as ever, the ambassador Chapuis in early 1536 after Anne's miscarriage. In that report, Jane is actually mentioned by name. Personally, I don't subscribe to the notion that their love affair commenced at Wolf Hall, as romantic as it sounds. You know, the king would have known Jane for quite some time, but I don't believe he began to woo her until after that final terrible miscarriage when he seriously began reconsidering his marriage to Anne.
Yeah, and to that progress, both Henry and Anne were having quite a great time. It was a real high in their relationship. And of course, she falls pregnant during that progress. So it seems to me unlikely as well that they would have had this incredible romantic affair. Well, for, you know, it's good for fiction, though, isn't it? That's great.
It is. It is very good for fiction. And it's a nice, well, I don't know if I'd call it a nice story, but you know what I mean? It's like a romantic kind of Hallmark sort of story, but I just don't think that that's the way it actually happened.
All right, now we'll fast forward a little bit. So the king and Jane were married on the 30th of May, 1536. Do we know any details about the ceremony or any of the celebrations that followed?
The ceremony itself was shrouded in secrecy. You know, it was held privately in the Queen's closet at York Place with Archbishop Cranmer presiding. And of course, this probably felt pretty insulting to Jane. But, you know, it would have been in very poor taste to hold an extravagant affair so quickly after Anne's execution. Already the people were murmuring against it. You know, historians are split as to whether there were any public celebrations of the marriage. But after reading the contemporary sources, I'm in agreement with Elizabeth Norton that, you know, the marriage was kept secret a few days until Jane was formally presented as queen on June 4th. At that time, a huge banquet was held and Jane was given the grants for the properties that made up her jointure and the infamous Holbein cup, which if you've ever seen a sketch is just unbelievably gorgeous and I would have loved to see it in real life.
So how did the general public, obviously, you know, Anne was only executed on the 19th of May. Everything had happened so quickly. At the end of April, she's still the king's beloved wife. And then now there's a new queen that, you know, people don't know very much about. So how did the general public and those at court react to the news of Henry's third marriage?
They certainly didn't revile the turn of events as some did when Henry married Anne, but there was certainly a lot of side eye going on. Anne's death was pretty shocking and unexpected. An anointed Queen of England had never been put to death before. In a letter to Jane before their wedding, Henry mentions that there had been some derisive ballads circulating and, you know, he assured her that he was doing his best to suppress them and encouraged her to ignore them, you know, but of course, gossip sells. So there was a lot of that. And, you know, people were obviously taken aback by the king's behavior. But still, there was far less outcry than there had been when Catherine was put aside. I think people were mostly just really shocked, at Anne's manner of death.
Yeah, and I suppose after the king, you know, executed his own wife and best buddies, I don't think you're going to want to open your mouth and complain too much about his choice of wife.
Absolutely not. No.
So the day following Anne's execution, Henry and Jane were actually betrothed formally. And then on the 4th of June, 1536, Jane was officially proclaimed queen at Greenwich. Yet she was never actually crowned like her predecessors, Catherine or Anne, were. So I know you've looked into this or we've had some discussions about this. Why do you think this is that she wasn't crowned?
The plague seems to have been particularly bad that year, and we do know that Jane had a very deep-seated fear of illness. You know, she lost her two younger siblings to either the plague or the sweat. So it seems like she had a real terror of falling sick. And it's something that has been commented on frequently in the historical record. Lady Lyle's man, John Hussey, you know, he wrote about it frequently in his letters. Like, you wouldn't believe how fearful this queen is. So I think that that had some to do with it. And I do think that there is some truth to Henry's use of it as an excuse for putting off the coronation. But I think, you know, he had other motives. Early in the autumn, the Pilgrimage of Grace broke out. So money was tight and there was no mood for celebration. And additionally, you know, the king often commented to courtiers and ambassadors alike that he expected never to get children from Jane. He also made remarks about wishing he hadn't rushed into marriage with her. So, you know, I think in the end, Jane's failure to fall pregnant quickly was the most likely factor in the holdup. He was not going to crown her until she made good on her duties to provide him with a son.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm glad you mentioned our friend John Hussey, who we both absolutely adore.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I love him. He would be the perfect boyfriend because... Like, I read his letters to Lady Lyle, and he's always asking her how she's doing, praying for her when she was pregnant, and, you know, and he's just kind of like a little gossiper, too, and his letters crack me up sometimes.
Actually, that's given me an idea, Adrian. I think we should do another episode in the future on John Hussey and his letters, because yes. Just for anyone listening, he was one of the Lyle's London agents, and he was in constant communication with them because they were based in Calais. And it was just, you know, the Lyle letters are the best in terms of a source for this period of time, but he is just a wonderful character. Unfortunately, I don't think there's very much known about him apart from that he, you know, wrote these amazing letters.
There's not. The only thing that I discovered was that his dad was a winemaker. Okay. I did discover that, but it seems like he never got married, which is a total shame because I think he would have been a good husband. But yeah, he just kind of, you know, that was what he did. He took care of the Lyle's business in England. And, you know, we really don't know anything about him outside of what's in those letters. And they don't reveal very much about him. It does reveal a lot about his character, but not necessarily his background.
Yeah, I do quite like how he's writing during Anne's execution and all of these incredible events. And he's so compassionate and kind. He never really ever, you know, says anything nasty, or he just delivers the news. And in a way, I sort of sense that he was very shocked by the whole affair and a little bit upset that his friends had been executed, because he did know all of them, of course, communicating with them, and that all these new people had been brought in.
Right. It was really a shocking turn of events, and, you know, all of those connections to be lost because they were very powerful men.
Definitely. All right. Sorry for that little, that's veering off into the world of the Lyle letters.
Let's get back on course. I love talking about John Hussey.
I know.
He's like my favorite man of the Tudor period.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's fantastic. Now, Jane. Sorry, Jane. I knew this would happen if I start talking about Jane. Jane Seymour, distracted. Jane presided over her own household as queen. Can you tell us about some of those who served her? And I know normally there's quite a bit of an overlap with the staff from one queen to another. We saw that with Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. Could you talk to us about the people serving Jane? Were there many of those Anne's former staff?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Nearly all of the women who served Jane also served Anne. The only difference is that the ladies from the more conservative families, those who adhered to the old faith, were in far greater positions of prominence. You know, so they seemed to kind of move up and were more favored by Jane, obviously, because Jane was very conservative. I would say probably the most notable woman in Jane's service was Jane Boleyn, Lady Rochford. It seems sort of suspect to us now that she would willingly serve the woman who replaced her sister-in-law, but it was likely that Lady Rochford really had little choice in the matter. She needed to make a living, and working for the queen was the best way to make money. It was the most secure way to make money, especially if one had had to present themselves as a member of the nobility, as Jane did. Another notable maid was, of course, Marjorie Horseman. She seems to have been one of the queen's favorites, moving up from mistress of the robes under Anne to keeper of the jewels under Jane, a position that she, interestingly, held jointly with her husband, Michael Lister. Places in the royal household were extremely competitive, and throughout the entirety of Jane's reign, Honor Lyle, again, was pretty hell-bent on getting her daughters into one of the coveted positions. There are lots of back and forth about that. In the end, it was Anne Bassett who was chosen, and I'm sure she was disappointed to swear her oath on the day her mistress went into confinement, only to be left unemployed a month later when the queen died in childbirth. But, you know, luckily for Anne, the king kind of took a bit of a fancy to her. And there were actually rumors that she may become his next queen after Jane's death. But, of course, that was only just rumor. But she did get a really sweet horse and saddle out of the deal.
Well, she can't complain then if she got a good horse and saddle. I do feel a bit for Honor Lyle, I have to say, because she spent, you know, a good deal of Anne Boleyn's reign trying to get livery off her. She desperately wanted Anne's livery. And it took, I think she got a kirtle. I can't remember the exact date, but really only a few months before Anne was executed. So, of course, then wasn't able to wear the lovely kirtle for very long. So, and then she spent the rest of the time trying to get her daughters into. So, and doing it from a distance, obviously, must have been really tricky.
Yeah. And I think, honestly, you know, Honor was, she very much ingratiated herself with Anne. You know, that's where Anne's dog came from, Perkoi.
Yes.
And, you know, she always was sending Anne, you know, gifts and trying to get her livery and all of those things. And so I think part of the reason why Jane was hesitant to take on, you know, either of her daughters was for a couple of reasons. One being how much Honor ingratiated herself with Anne, but also because I think Jane may have been fearful because Anne Bassett grew up in France, you know, and she was sort of similar qualities to Anne Boleyn. And I think she kind of was protecting herself in a way of really putting off Honor as much as she could without, you know, bringing in this competition, really. But eventually, you know, she got worn down.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. I haven't thought about it like that. That's really, really interesting. Now, Jane, let's talk about Jane and Henry.
Okay.
So what do the sources reveal about their relationship? Like, we don't often hear too much about their actual relationship. Was theirs a happy marriage?
No, I don't. I don't think so. My personal, I don't. You know, I think that there were some highs, but I think there were also a great many lows. Every time Jane dared to have an opinion, it seems like she was very brutally slapped down, oftentimes in front of other courtiers. You know, Henry had no qualms complaining about her to just about anyone who would listen, whining about how he would never get a child from her, or wishing aloud that he had not rushed so quickly into marriage when two pretty maids walked by. And he liked to remind her that he could have her dispatched just like his other wives if she ever stepped out of line. You know, quite frankly, I think today we would see their marriage as very dysfunctional and abusive, at least if not physically, then certainly emotionally. It's like that saying, there's like a nursery rhyme. So like when it was good, it was really good. But when it was bad, it was horrid. And I think that's true, you know, because she did have some good moments, particularly after she got pregnant and she was rising kind of in her stature, but she never ever wielded the same kind of political influence as Anne or Catherine. And it seems like anytime she opened her mouth to try to speak up for anything, Henry very much put her in her place. So, you know, it's kind of no surprise to me that she often acted more simple than she probably really was. most likely, because it was probably, you know, a preservation, self-preservation.
Absolutely. So, yeah. A protective mechanism. Yeah, definitely. I do feel for her. She was in an absolutely awful position. I really can't think of anything worse. That's really quite heartbreaking, isn't it? So on the 12th of October, 1537, was a really good moment for Jane. Edward, and for Henry, I suppose. Prince Edward was born at Hampton Court Palace. So can you talk us through, I just want to hear a little bit about what we know about the labour. I think I've definitely read that it was quite a difficult labour, difficult birth, and then the 12 days leading to Jane's death.
So, yeah, Edward's birth was, by all accounts, somewhat treacherous. And I think this is part of what drew me to Jane's story, because I, too, had a fairly traumatic birth experience, and it has shaped me as a person. So I often wonder what Jane may have been like had she lived through it. What sort of queen would she have been? You know, it might make for an interesting alternate story. but in any case, you know, Jane went into confinement in mid-September, but things didn't really get moving until October 9th, and she labored for 3 very intense days. She was eventually able to successfully deliver the prince, but not without much anxiety and distress, and she was probably exhausted to the point of breaking. But she did put on a good show through Edward's christening and the celebrations that followed. Yet within 2 days, they were preparing for her death. You know, they gave her last rites, and she seemed to rally for a time. And she had what was referred to as a natural lax, but historians can't really seem to agree on just what that was, whether it was an outpouring of blood from infection or stool from food poisoning. You know, and of course, their interpretation of that usually affects what they believe her cause of death was. The very same night, she fell unconscious and was once again given the last rites, and she never recovered. So, you know, as I said before, theories sort of abound as to the cause of her death. Everything from childbed fever to retained placenta to a blood clot. And Cromwell pinned the lion's share of the blame on her ladies, saying that they had allowed her to eat whatever she wanted. And then, of course, others, you know, on the continent kind of pointed the finger of blame at him and the king for neglecting her. So, you know, we really don't know exactly why she died. But what we do know for certain is that her death was not due to a botched cesarean.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that, because that does pop up from time to time. So that's good to clarify those misconceptions. So obviously Jane's reign was very brief. What would you say were the main highlights, if there were any, or Anne's, sorry, I called her Anne, dearie me, or Jane's, Jane's main achievements in that time?
You know, people often credit her with bringing Mary and Elizabeth back into the fold, but the truth is that she did very little for Mary and next to nothing for Elizabeth. I know that that seems very taboo to say that, but after reading the documents, I mean, I think that that's the truth. If anything, Mary was welcomed back despite Jane's efforts rather than because of them, because every time she tried to speak out for her, of course, the king, you know, took her down a peg. So, you know, but once it was safe to support the elder princess, Jane was an admirable stepmother. She was really the first to show Mary any affection and probably kept her from being further damaged than she already was. Politically, Jane has no credits. She tried to stand up for the rebels during the Pilgrimage of Grace, but as again, that came to naught. I think, horrible as it is to say, Jane's greatest achievement was giving birth to Prince Edward. Had she not done so, Jane and possibly the rest of the Seymour family would have likely gone the way of the Boleyns. It's really unfortunate that she wasn't around to kind of enjoy that achievement.
You spent a long time, you know, writing this book, researching this book. Did your views about Jane change during that time?
Oh, absolutely. I always bought the image of her as this meek sheep who just sort of let everyone run all over her. And now I see her as someone who is much more complex. She learned pretty early on that to speak her mind was to bring about the king's wrath. But that didn't always stop her. You know, every time he would get after her, then a couple of weeks later, she would do it again as carefully as she could. So I think that was kind of brave of her to do that. And, you know, she did so much to sort of preserve herself. But there were times when she did speak up, when she felt really passionate about something. She picked her battles and very skillfully presented herself in a way that would put her in the best position. But she wasn't always successful at it. She was very human. And I think she tried to be the best queen that she could be with the limited power she had. I think she just found herself in just this really difficult position. And I'm of the belief that I still haven't decided how much I credit her with bringing about Anne's downfall. I think Anne would have fallen with or without Jane's involvement. So I'm not really sure how much I'm willing to credit her with, but I think that even if she had been a real powerful voice in taking down Anne, I don't think that she ever expected that Henry would execute his wife. So I try to remember what it must have felt like for her to wake up on the morning of May 20th after Anne is dead and she's going to be betrothed to her murderer. How did she feel in that moment? Because I think any human would probably be scared to death. So I think she probably was very shocked, as everybody else was. But at that point, there was no going back. There was no changing your mind. There was no, oh, never mind. I want to marry you. I think she just had to make the best out of a very complex and difficult situation. So I try to give her a lot more grace than I did in the past.
Fantastic. And is there something specific that you learned or something specific that surprised you that made you rethink anything at all?
Well, I was really surprised to discover that Jane's father had passed away a year earlier than thought. And of course, I learned that on Sarah Morris's podcast. Knowing that he died before his daughter caught the king's eye put things in a much different perspective for me. It put much more emphasis on Edward Seymour's role in maneuvering Jane into place. And it also explained why all of the favors seemed to fall to him rather than to their father. Because, of course, Thomas Boleyn, he got some pretty nice stuff out of being the father to the queen. And, of course, John Seymour never received anything. And that always sort of stumped me. And so learning that he most likely died a year beforehand really explained that. And showed how much more power Edward wielded as the de facto leader of the family.
So, Adrian, where can listeners find out more about you, your books, your upcoming novel?
I'm on all the social media, Facebook, Twitter. I have a website, adrian-dillard.com. And you can find my books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much anywhere that books are sold, you can find them there.
Fantastic. Now, I can't let you go yet, though. I have to still ask you some other questions. So are you ready for our little game of 10 to go?
This is where I always get nervous. Yes.
Don't get nervous. It's all good. So who is somebody you admire and maybe why briefly as well?
Well, I really admire the financial advisor that I work for. He is just really an incredible person and has been there for me through so much of the difficulties that I have been going through the last couple of months. And, you know, he is just a true friend and honorable, and he's just a really, really great. And he's so involved in the community. He's a firefighter in addition to being a financial advisor, and he does a lot. So he's kind of my hero right now.
Oh, that's so lovely. And I think you've kind of answered my next question, which I was going to ask, what's something you love about your day job? So
It's the advisor that I work for.
Excellent. That was fantastic.
Yeah, we've worked together for 8 years now, and he started out as my boss, but then we moved to a different office, and so now I have a different boss, but I still work for him. And actually, so there's a character in The Raven's Widow, if you've read it, the scene where she gets into the snowball fight at Beaulieu, the servant that she gets into the snowball fight with is based upon Derek. That's my advisor.
Oh, that's lovely. So, Adrian, what was your favorite subject at school?
History.
Oh, history. And what's your favorite game or sport to watch or play?
Ooh, figure skating.
Ah, figure skating. There you go. And what's something new that you've learned during this pandemic, whether it be something that you've learned or something you've learned about other people or anything?
That is such a good question. What have I learned? I think I've learned, because of course some stuff has been going on in my life during the pandemic, I have learned how capable I am.
I love to hear that. That's absolutely fantastic. And can I just echo that you are incredibly capable? Just wanted to throw that in. Now, have you ever had a nickname?
Yes. When I was a kid, my cousin and I were best friends, and her name was her name is Tammy Jo, and mine is Adrian Janine. And so we were TJ and AJ.
Oh.
And my mom, she would call me Adrian Janini Weenie.
I love the names that mothers come up with. They're particularly fascinating, aren't they, for their children?
Yes.
I love it. Awesome. All right. So if you had to be stranded on a desert island with someone from Tudor history, who would it be?
I think it's going to have to be John Hussey.
Yes, I thought when I wrote that question, I thought, I know who Adrian's going to pick. You're going to have to fight me for him, though.
Or maybe George Boleyn. As long as he had his lute and he could make up poems to entertain me.
Now, a bit random here. Do you love or hate roller coasters?
Oh, I hate them.
Yeah, I don't like them anymore either. I used to when I was young, and now I'm like, no.
No, and in fact, I'm not a big fan of rides in general, with the exception of the Escape from Gringotts ride at, Harry Potter at Universal Studios. Yes. That's actually really fun. But the rest, I could just, leave them.
Excellent. Now, do you collect anything?
Besides Tudor books?
Yeah, besides Tudor books.
I collect Harry Potter Legos.
Legos. Okay. There you go. Something to keep in mind, everyone, for Adrian's birthday or Christmas.
Yes. Well, I have a lot of Harry Potter sort of memorabilia in general, but I have a lot of the Lego sets, which are really fun to put together.
Now, lucky last question. Do you believe in past lives?
Yes, I do. I had a past life regression where, I had an experience that was pretty convincing. I'm still, because of course your rational mind kind of says, no, that's not possible. But I think as an author, you have to be very open about your imagination. And, you have to be open to those sorts of ideas. And so I am open to that. I think it would be really, really neat.
Yeah. I think you and I are going to have to talk more about that after. All right. Yeah. So very last thing, the Tudor takeaway. So this is a little gem for our listeners to take away with them, something for them to check out after the episode. It might be a website or a song to listen to or a book to read. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Okay, I have two, a fiction and nonfiction. So the fiction book I would suggest if you want to read, there are not a whole lot of books out there about Jane Seymour, novels, but there is one that I read called The May Bride, and that is by, I'm completely blanking on her name right now, Susanna Dunn.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's really interesting because it's just like a snapshot of Jane's early life. And it's as much her story as the story of Catherine Filial, who was Edward Seymour's first wife. And it was just, it was something that I had never read anything, you know, told that early in Jane's life, away from court, in the countryside. And I mean, it's just beautiful writing, and it just draws you into the story. So that's a really good fiction book about Jane Seymour. And then my nonfiction is, of course, The Lyell Letters. So there is an abridged version, which is good. But if you can get your hands on the total, it's like a 6-volume set. Basically, it's the letter, it's all of the letters, but then it also goes along with the historian's sort of interpretations of the letters, background about what was going on at court at the time, backgrounds about these personalities and all of the different kind of, complex relationships. In fact, I was very interested to learn that Edward Seymour and Lord Lyell had a bit of a financial quarrel, and it went on for several years. And so, and I think that that could be possibly another reason why Jane was so kind of cold to the Lyells. That was something I had never learned, but that was something that I read in that book. So if you can get the full volume set, I totally recommend it. But if not, definitely read the abridged version.
Yeah, I totally agree with that last takeaway. I agree with Susanna Dunn's book too, but I love the Lyell Letters. And I think it's Muriel St. Clair Byrne who edits them, and she's done an incredible job. And a lot of the times she's been able to rectify some issues that have been published in the calendars, the letters and papers, and she's found misdates, dates that have been incorrect and information, because she's looked at every original letter, which is mind-boggling because there are thousands. I think, I want to say 3,000, something like that, 3,000, maybe more, I can't remember now. And so she's been able to really bring some new information. And so I absolutely love them as well. So yeah, if you can get your hands on them, go for it. Now, Adrian, it's time for me to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining me on Talking Tudors again. And we are definitely going to get talking about this John Hussey episode.
Yes, for sure. Thank you so much for having me, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as TheMostHappy78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.